De Gaulle himself, Bideau later observed, never said a word about the Marshall Plan, but accused the Americans of being opportunists, ignoramuses, and exploiters. Whatever legitimate grudges against the Americans the French people might harbor, however, nothing to Bideau's mind could do justice to General Marshall and to the generosity of the American people. He would not let the present opportunity slip. Hailing Marshall's speech for its acuity in identifying the nature and origins of Europe's economic plight, Bideau wasted no time highlighting for Molotov what would be the insurmountable block to Russian cooperation. That to enlist the interest of the greatest creditor nation of the world, Europe's aid request would have to follow a coherent program, drawn up in concert based on its combined balance sheet. To this end, a steering committee of participating governments should be established, he said, with the aim of completing a comprehensive report by the 1st of September. This was, in Bideau's rendering, to be no reprisal of wartime lend-lease, under which the Soviets simply submitted demands to Washington for expeditious fulfillment. Bideau's tone was confident, his reasoning clear and fluid, until he turned to the problem of Germany. It was here that he sounded less like a statesman in control of his brief and more like a spokesman awaiting one. Germany's reconstruction, he said, raises precisely all the questions upon which it has so far been impossible to reach an agreement, such as the level of German industry, reparations, the regime for the Ruhr, etc. It is true this presents a difficulty which cannot be denied. Indeed, Bideau's own government was in a muddle on these matters. The September report should, he concluded, be drawn up without prejudice to our decisions as regards the final state of Germany. Molotov responded with the official Soviet opening statement the following day, June 28. The contrast to Bideau's gloss was stark, concurring only that reconstruction and the subsequent economic development of the countries of Europe would be facilitated if the United States could provide these countries with the economic assistance which they need. He framed Marshall's proposal as an American response to an American problem. It is to the interest of the United States to make use of the possibilities of their credit to enlarge their foreign markets, especially in view of the approaching crisis, that being the inevitable and imminent crisis of capitalism. The Soviet government had nonetheless accepted the Franco-British invitation to discuss the proposal, notwithstanding the fact that the planning, which is the basis of the socialist economy of the Soviet Union, excludes the danger of the crises and economic troubles which are the theme of the American minister's speech. As for the plan of work drawn up by the French government and supported by the British government, however, Molotov's government had serious doubts. It seemed perfectly clear that questions of internal economy were a matter concerning the sovereignty of the peoples themselves. France had her own economic plan, as did Britain. The Soviet people, for their part, were at present engaged in the successful execution of their Stalin plan, a five-year plan that ensures a steady increase in the material and cultural prosperity of the Soviet people. For the countries of Europe to decide for themselves what American aid they require was, therefore, all well and good. Each country knew its needs and interests. But attempts made from without to intervene in the economic life of various countries have not had nor can have any positive effects. Thus, the present attempts made to force the conference to proceed to perfect a general economic program for the European nations, which would inevitably involve the intervention of certain states, could not serve as a basis for collaboration. Through a strategy of imposing bilateral trade agreements on Eastern European countries, Moscow had, since the war, redirected trade patterns in the region toward the Soviet Union. This was integral to its ambition of creating a permanent security zone between itself and Germany. Anglo-French support for an American plan to reintegrate the Eastern economies with those of the West therefore represented a threat to Soviet economic and political control over this zone. As for the problem of Germany, Molotov continued, it is a problem quite apart. The various unresolved questions should not be discussed in Paris, but should remain the exclusive purview of the Council of Foreign Ministers. The floor was now Bevin's. In spite of Molotov's disparaging of the French and British plans, which confirmed Bevin's beliefs about Moscow's unwillingness to cooperate, he was determined to test the limits of his diplomatic powers before conceding what would be a risky breakdown in Anglo-Soviet relations. The son of a farm laborer's widow, father unknown, the 66-year-old Bevin began life, the unlikeliest of prospects to become his country's chief diplomat. "He murdered the king's English," observed Clay, who marveled at witnessing him address George VI as plain king. Presented once with draft text intended to bear his name, he shook his head no. "It's just not me," he said. "You won't mind if I take it away and de-grammatize it." Orphaned at the age of 8, a school dropout at 11, Bevin toiled in hard manual labor jobs until 1911, at age 30, becoming a full-time union officer. He rose steadily through the ranks, working to create what would by the late 1930s become the world's largest trade union, the Transport and General Workers Union. It was his role as General Secretary that led Churchill to invite him in 1940 to become Minister of Labor in the wartime coalition government. Bevin became one of the Tory Prime Minister's most trusted Labor Party figures. He played a vital role in mobilizing British industry and the workforce to supply the mammoth war effort. With the upset Labour general election victory in July 1945, incoming Prime Minister Clement Attlee, to the approval of outgoing Foreign Secretary Anthony Eden and King George, added to the surprise by bypassing Hugh Dalton to name Bevin Foreign Secretary. The former union leader quickly put his stamp on the job, inspiring loyalty in the Foreign Office both for his integrity and his firm hold on diplomatic power. Still, many supporters and detractors alike viewed him as long-winded, vain, vindictive, profoundly suspicious, and prejudiced. He had issues with Jews, Germans, Roman Catholics, and intellectuals of all kinds, groups that, when taken together, comprised a large proportion of those with whom he had to deal. Truman considered Bevin a boor. Soviet diplomat Andrei Gromyko concurred. Acheson, however, who knew him far better, saw him in a much more affectionate light. "Ernie was solid, squared away to the world," Acheson said. "He had curious flashes of temper and anger, but if after testing you a little bit he decided he was your friend, he was, and that stood through thick and thin." John Maynard Keynes, Britain's storied economist, had in 1944 warned of an impending financial Dunkirk. After the cessation of American war aid, Britain would be unable to sustain its imperial commitments or meet its welfare state ambitions at home. Bevin would be obliged to preside over the former, though much of his diplomacy would be geared toward persuading his own countrymen that he was not. "I do not accept the view that we have ceased to be a great power," he intoned before the House of Commons on May 16, 1947. Yet 10 days prior he had told colleagues that he would have to bluff his way through in foreign policy, given the financial weakness of this country. And he warned British miners, his political base, that his ability to carry out an independent foreign policy was dependent on their willingness to provide him with more coal. Bevin resented American dollar diplomacy, in particular the linking of desperately needed financial assistance to London's submission on political matters central to British sovereignty. The American loan agreement, signed in December 1945, after nearly 4 months of difficult and often humiliating negotiations in Washington, required Britain to accept American air and naval bases on British and Commonwealth territory. Bevin's decision to support the manufacture of British nuclear weapons was driven not by a German or Soviet threat, but by his belief that the country could not afford to acquiesce in an American monopoly of the new development. Britain, as Bevin saw his country, was the last bastion of social democracy, standing against both the red tooth and claw of American capitalism and the communist dictatorship of Soviet Russia. It was the Soviets, however, whom Bevin knew to be the greater threat to British interests. No one, he told a group of left-wing critics in June 1946, had done more to defend the Russian Revolution than he. Yet what he got in return was Russian communists trying to break up the trade union that I built. The Soviets were not to be trusted. their stranglehold over Eastern Europe, closing the door and preventing entry or any contact with those people for trade or anything else, could not be abided. Their territorial ambitions cut across the throat of the British Commonwealth. With Bevan at the helm, British foreign policy was certainly more overtly hostile to Moscow than it would have been had the more accommodationist Attlee been able to run it himself. Still, Bevan was no cannon. He had no theory on the sources of Soviet conduct and was willing, at times seemingly eager, to suspend disbelief to probe for hidden good intentions. Bevan at times ascribed the unbending, even brutal nature of Russian negotiating behavior to inexperience and isolation. In November-December 1946, he had been part of the New York meeting of the Council of Foreign Ministers that forged agreement on peace treaties with Italy, Finland, Hungary, Bulgaria, and Romania, drawing optimistic inferences from the experience. "I think we are learning how to cooperate," Molotov had said on the boat back to Europe, and Bevan liked to cite this remark in evidence. Even after the March-April 1947 Foreign Ministers' meeting in Moscow, from which Marshall had returned to Washington wearing a shroud of gloom, Bevan was optimistic that slow progress was being made. Here in Paris now, Bevan's response to Molotov was unfailingly gracious. He ensured the Russian that he, Bevan, should not wish to be a party to any project that would interfere with the sovereignty of participating governments. Yet still it was necessary, he insisted, that we should undertake work in collaboration, and that our demands should be coordinated. For Molotov, sovereignty and coordination were incompatible conditions from which to approach American aid. Yet Bevan maintained, however implausibly, that Mr. Molotov's remarks provide the basis on which we can approach the problem from similar points of view. Following a second meeting with Bideau and Bevan on June 29th, Molotov sent a coded cable to Moscow, highlighting his effort to impress upon Bideau the gulf that existed between the Soviet and French visions for shaping Marshall's still hazy initiative. "The difference," Molotov reported having told Bideau, "is that the Soviet Union project limits the tasks to the discussion of the issues which are directly related to the American economic assistance to Europe, whereas the French project envisages also the design of economic programs which encompass both the domestic economies of European countries and economic relations between them." This had been Molotov's oblique way of telling Bideau that Moscow would be happy to submit an assistance request as part of a package of such national requests, but that it had no intention of subjecting its resources or requirements to external evaluation, or to participate in any form of coordination underwritten by Washington. Neither would it allow its satellites to do so. Molotov's suspicions of his counterpart's intentions were soon confirmed. The Kremlin was receiving a constant flow of intelligence from highly placed British sources, among whom Guy Burgess at the Foreign Office in London, and Donald Maclean at the British Embassy in Washington. Maclean, who had access to all of the embassy's classified cable traffic, was reporting, according to Pavel Sudoplatov, the spymaster who had overseen Trotsky's assassination, that the goal of the Marshall Plan was to ensure American economic domination of Europe. On the night of June 29th, a brown-jacketed Feldjäger, special messenger, raced through the streets of Moscow. Arriving at the Kremlin gates, he handed the guard an envelope marked "Very urgent." A few minutes later, Stalin, sitting in his dimly lit office, opened it and removed the intelligence report, growing increasingly indignant as he read. He quickly wrote out text and directed his secretary, Alexander Poskrobashev, to call Politburo members and request their approval. Once the last yes vote was secured in the early hours of June 30th, Poskrobashev told Vyshinsky to encipher the cable and send it to Paris. The message directed Molotov to obstruct Marshall's plan from being implemented in Eastern Europe. Clayton and Bevan, the cable explained, had agreed that the Marshall Plan was not to be focused on providing assistance of the sort that had been carried out by UNRWA, but rather exclusively on the long-term economic reconstruction of Europe. It was to be implemented outside the United Nations framework, for the reason that German industrial revival was considered essential to rehabilitation of the continent, and Germany was not a member of the UN. Most importantly, the cable stated, Britain and America will oppose payment of reparations to the Soviet Union from current production. At the time, reparations were the Soviet Union's only source of foreign capital, capital that was vital to modernizing its chemical and machine tool industries. At Yalta and Potsdam, Stalin believed he had secured Roosevelt's and Churchill's consent to a 5-year flow of German industrial machinery and goods. Yet the Kremlin's British moles now indicated that the United States and Great Britain would end this arrangement in favor of an American-controlled reconstruction scheme, partially financed by Germany. The Marshall Plan was, therefore, according to Sudoplatov, totally unacceptable because it would obstruct our consolidation of control in Eastern Europe. It meant that communist parties already established in Romania, Bulgaria, Poland, Czechoslovakia, and Hungary would be deprived of economic levers of power. Constructing a network of puppet regimes across Eastern Europe depended on Moscow's ability to strip Germany bare, funneling its resources through local communist parties into building a new command economy throughout the vast territories it occupied. It is no wonder that Molotov was cautioned to object to any discussion of the utilization of German economic resources to meet the requirements of European countries, or of economic assistance to Germany from the USA. Anything to do with Germany needed to be handled through the Allied Control Council, where we have the right to veto. At the June 30th meeting, Molotov had been raising relatively minor questions and objections when an assistant handed him Vyshinsky's decoded cable. It seems, Acheson recalls from accounts of the meeting, that Molotov has a bump on his forehead, which swells when he is under emotional strain. As Molotov read the telegram, he turned pale and the bump on his forehead swelled. After that, his attitude suddenly changed, and he became much more harsh. Molotov told Bideau and Bevan that the German issue and the drafting of an all-around program for the European countries were not proper subjects for their present conference. Reading from the telegram, he retreaded his arguments of the prior 3 days. In effect, Bevan said, smiling disbelievingly, what you are asking the United States government to do is to give us a blank check. If I were to go to Moscow with a blank check and ask you to sign it, I wonder how far I would get with your end. Bideau nodded in agreement. The inevitable split between Moscow and the London-Paris axis had arrived. Shortly after adjourning, the Soviet delegation, in a departure from their previous insistence on keeping the discussions secret, bared its objections to the French proposal in a public statement distributed to the TASS news agency. That evening, Molotov cabled back to Stalin that Britain and France were now in dire straits and that their only hope was the United States, which demands that they set up some kind of European body to facilitate interference in the economic and political affairs of Europe. Britain and to some extent France count on using this body to promote their own interests. Bideau's frustrations boiled over on July 1st. He began by calling it grave that, on the eve of a decision, the three delegations might not reach an understanding. He drew attention to the fundamental differences between the Soviet and French positions. First, the Soviets proposed to establish only a list of needs in American credits that would be received by a European committee for transmission to the United States. France believed this was entirely insufficient. Mr. Marshall's text is perfectly clear, Bideau stressed. If there is no European mutual aid, there is no American aid. Second, Mr. Molotov fears that such a general economic plan may result in an interference in the internal affairs of European states and be an infringement of their sovereignty. This was, however, something that the French delegation has never foreseen or considered or admitted. Sovereignty was to remain sacrosanct. Bideau and Molotov were by this time talking past each other. Sovereignty in the context of the Marshall Plan was, for Bideau, European governments making autonomous decisions regarding what adjustments in their economic structures they were willing to make in order to satisfy, with as little wastage of scarce resources as possible, the combined needs of their people. And such adjustments were essential to securing American aid, which was itself essential to ensuring that Europe had adequate provisions to allow them to be implemented without further hardship. For Molotov, the requirement for mutual adjustment was an imposition from without, and therefore a fundamental interference with sovereignty. And if the Americans were determined to usurp sovereign powers as the price for their assistance, then Europeans simply had to reject it. Molotov reported home that no joint decisions on the substance of the issue in question were likely, as the Soviet stand differs in its essence from the Anglo-French position. At this point, however, he was still willing to engage with his French and British counterparts, believing that their differences with the United States would doom Marshall's scheme. "But I changed my mind," Molotov later recalled. Western tensions, he decided, would be greater with Moscow out of the picture. So I sent a second memorandum, this time saying he wanted to reject the plan. Tito deputy Gilles remembers things differently. In Paris, for a congress of the French Communist Party, he was invited to lunch at the Soviet embassy, with jazz playing in the background. Best for thwarting listening devices, the Russians explained. Molotov said he had been ordered to oppose the plan by the Politburo. In any case, it was to be a fateful decision. On July 2nd, at the fifth and final meeting, Molotov adopted a completely uncompromising attitude, Bevan recorded. The Russian laced into the latest French proposal for an all-embracing European program, to be elaborated by a new organization standing above the European countries, demanding their obedient behavior and intervening in their internal affairs. One day Poland will be told, produce more coal. The next, Czechoslovakia will be told to buy machines abroad and grow more crops. They were to lose their former economic and national independence to the advantage of certain strong powers as a mere pretext for securing some undetermined American aid. The Soviet governments, Molotov pronounced, cannot, of course, take this course. Bevan turned to Bob Dixon, his private secretary, whispering, this really is the birth of the Western Bloc. Molotov plowed on. As for Germany, it was unacceptable that its resources should be used for any purpose rather than reparations. Germany could not be the beneficiary of an Allied reconstruction scheme. Yet in the next breath he blasted the Western powers for harming the country through federalization. Molotov insisted that only the genuine restoration of Germany as a united democratic state could ensure that the needs of the German people were met. The Franco-British proposal, he concluded, would lead to nothing good. It would split Europe into two groups of states and will create new difficulties in the mutual relations between them. In this event, American credits will serve not the economic restoration of Europe, but rather the exploitation of weaker countries by certain strong powers striving for domination. The Soviet government, he ended ominously, considers it necessary to warn the governments of Britain and France of the consequences of such action. Bideau was furious. Mr. Molotov concludes by warning my country, but I for my part would like to warn the Soviet delegation against any action which might lead to the separation of Europe into two groups. The sovereignty and independence of all European nations, he insisted, would be fully respected. What was being asked of them was nothing more than national statistics, freely and independently provided, that would be brought together and compared so as to determine resources and needs to create a European balance sheet. Mr. Molotov had noted that American aid is uncertain, he said, but it would be even more so if the data of the problem are not respected. And if, of course, Europe does not speak up and say what she can do for herself and what we all lack. Regarding Mr. Molotov's protestations that Poland could be ordered to produce more coal or Czechoslovakia less machinery, this claim was, Bideau insisted, nonsense. It is in independence and for independence that their collaboration is sought. As for the objection that France was proposing a decisive place for the United States in the restoration of the economic life of the European countries, Bideau explained that decisive did not mean principal. At Waterloo, he noted, the decisive role, as opposed to the principal role, was played by a few thousand men who arrived at the last moment. Likewise, with the Marshall Plan, it was each European nation, and all of us together, that would play the principal role. Yet in the coming months the American role would indeed be decisive, in that They are the few thousand men who will decide the battle and the victory over misery. For Molotov, such clarification was sterile pedantry. The Soviet Union was not about to collaborate in a new European battle in which the American role was to be decisive. If the United States wished to provide assistance for the recovery of the European nations, which was, after all, of vital and pressing interest to the survival of American capitalism, such a proposal would receive Soviet consideration. Yet there could be no American meddling in the sovereign internal affairs of these nations, as the French and British advocated. Bevin joined in, condemning Molotov's statement as a travesty of the facts. British policy, he insisted, was to cooperate with all and dominate none. And with regard to the division of Europe, nobody had striven more than I, he added, for the unity of Europe and that of Germany. As for the grave consequences with which Molotov threatened Britain, such threats had never and would not cause us to hesitate to pursue what we considered to be our duty. He pledged, like Bideau, to take Marshall's proposal forward. Molotov stood, announcing that the Soviet Union was withdrawing from discussions. The Marshall Plan, he said, was nothing but a vicious American scheme for using dollars to buy its way into European affairs. His delegation followed him out of the hall. Molotov could have killed the Marshall Plan by joining it, Harriman later reflected disbelievingly. Bevin did a superb job of getting Molotov out of Paris by careful maneuvering. He had the courage to invite Molotov and the bluntness to get rid of him. But falling into the trap confirmed the Russian as essentially a dull fellow. Bideau agreed. I could never figure out why Molotov had acted like that. If he had continued to side with us, he could not have lost anything, but he chose the only way to lose for sure. Sometimes the communists do strange things, Burns told Bideau. If Molotov had stayed in Paris, he could have referred to the Potsdam Accords in order to demand 50% of all available financial assets. This would have embarrassed the United States as much as France. Then Molotov would have demanded aid for Yugoslavia, Poland, etc. It is difficult to believe that this would have been acceptable to Congress. In deciding to act otherwise, Moscow has greatly aided the United States. For Paul Hoffman, Republican founder of an influential business leaders forum, who would soon play a vital role in taking the Marshall Plan from idea to program, the Molotov walkout was a watershed. It made it transparently clear that Russia was not interested in European reconstruction, but in chaos. Of course, Molotov was not the decision-maker, Stalin was. Kennan had applied keen insights into the systematic defects in the Soviet leader's psychology, pulling off a maneuver worthy of Clausewitz. The Soviets and their satellites could have bled Marshall's offer to death, with demands and grievances over terms. Instead, Stalin allowed himself to be goaded into rejecting it, casting the Soviet Union as an enemy of recovery. We were fortunate in our opponents, concluded a relieved Acheson. Uncle Joe helped us again, Harriman added. Always finely attired, at home in high society, Dean Acheson lived a lifestyle government service could not finance. A return to his law practice being the only alternative to austerity, he stepped down, as scheduled, on July 1, 1947. 51-year-old banker and former Stimson deputy Robert Lovett succeeded him. Lovett would oversee progress of the Marshall Plan through its most critical period. Thin, bald, with high, sharp cheekbones, Lovett operated on a constant high-intensity nervous energy. Born to wealth, with an accent to match, he was nonetheless dubious of diplomats and Washington elites, preferring the company of artists, writers, even enlisted men. Reserved, cautious, humorous, profane, and practical, he was an implementer and not an innovator. He had little time for the egos around the administration, men like General Clay. As Marshall would spend much of the remainder of his tenure traveling abroad and recuperating from medical interventions, Lovett would drive deliberations on the substance of the Marshall Plan forward. Though a friend of Acheson's from their days at Yale, he took a more skeptical view of an expansive role for the United States in global affairs. The United States should not, he felt, aim to fill Britain's former role. The country had first to build up its resources and to focus them on countering the immediate threat, Soviet aggression. On July 3rd, Bideau and Bevin issued a joint communique from Paris announcing the invitation of 22 European countries to cooperate in devising a collective plan for European recovery. The assemblage, it said, would begin work on July 12th and complete it by September 1st, after which it would submit the agreed blueprint and request for economic assistance to the United States. Bideau sent a copy of the formal invitation to the Soviet ambassador in Paris, assuring him that his country would still be welcome to participate were his government to change its decision. Bideau's deputies, however, privately offered a different statement of his views. "The Soviets," they told Ambassador Caffery, "have forced Europe to band together to save itself. The Kremlin is hoping to exploit the chaos that will follow economic collapse and take over the Western European countries with their well-organized communist parties. Yet its desire to sabotage European reconstruction will be as clearly revealed as is our determination to save ourselves and to profit from the splendid initiative taken by Secretary Marshall." On July 4th, American Independence Day, French Prime Minister Paul Ramadier called for and won a vote of confidence over the government's support for the Marshall Plan. Meanwhile, matters between Washington and Moscow were rapidly deteriorating, with Stalin now convinced that the United States was using the Marshall Plan to keep its military in Europe. The breakdown in relations reverberated around the globe. Negotiations between the USSR and the United States over the formation of an interim Korean government collapsed. That same day, the Communist Party of the Soviet Union, CPSU, cabled 7 East European Communist Party leaders telling them that, whereas the Soviet Union had rejected the Marshall Plan, it would be better for their governments not to refuse to participate in the upcoming Paris meeting, and instead to send their delegations to show the unacceptability of the Anglo-French plan and to prevent its unanimous adoption. Their delegations should then leave the meeting, potentially with more delegates from other countries. Molotov reinforced the message in telegrams to his embassies on July 5th and 6th. On the 7th, the Central Committee called Tito, praising his firmness on the issue of the American enslaving loans, but telling him it would be better to take part before walking out. This position, however, was not to be Moscow's last word. As eager expressions of interest came forward from Czechoslovakia and Poland, the Kremlin did an about-face. "At first we decided to propose to all socialist countries to participate," Molotov explained years later, "but we quickly realized that was wrong. The problem was that we still could not count on them," singling out the Czechs for particular suspicion. Satellite participation in the Marshall Plan was a possibility Moscow could not abide. It would restore East-West trade links that had been superseded by bilateral ones imposed by Moscow after the war. It was only a matter of time before American political influence set in among them. From this point on, then, the Soviet Union would rely on unilateral action to protect its interests. For Marshall, the epiphany that U.S.-Soviet cooperation had outlived its usefulness came on April 15, 1947, during his meeting in Moscow with Stalin. For Stalin, it would not come for another 3 months, with the imminent threat of the Marshall Plan incorporating Germany and the East. If one wants to set a firm birth date for the Cold War, therefore, a strong case can be made for July 7, 1947, the day that Molotov ordered further cables to be dispatched to the satellites, rescinding his previous day's instructions for them to send delegations to Paris. It was only at this point that both sides, the United States and the Soviet Union, became irrevocably committed to securing their respective spheres of influence, politically, economically, and militarily, without mutual consultation. Europe, which had previously been divided into allies, former enemies, and neutrals, was now divided between Marshall states and the Soviet bloc. Problems, Molotov told the eastern states, had emerged. Britain and France do not now intend to carry out changes in their plan for economic recovery in Europe without adverse considerations for the sovereignty and economic independence of small countries. European recovery, moreover, was being used as a pretext for creating an anti-Soviet Western bloc, which was to include Germany. The governments were now, therefore, advised not to participate, although each could present its own grounds for refusal. Most of the eastern states understood the non-negotiability of the new instructions and rejected or backed out of the Paris Initiative immediately. The Romanian government explained that the Franco-British proposal would lead inescapably to a breach of independence and a meddling in the domestic affairs of European countries. Moreover, any plan for economic stabilization of Europe may reach its goals only by cooperation with the USSR. Yugoslavia, which had been prepared to follow earlier instructions to send a delegation and give a good fight to America and its satellites before walking out, now denounced it. Foreign Minister Stanoja Šimić said the Franco-British outline would allow certain powers to interfere with the economic and political sovereignty of other countries, and free Germany from obligations to compensate its victims. In an interview, Tito accused the United States of disingenuous intents and trying to isolate his country through some kind of economic blockade. The Poles, who had been planning to send cabinet ministers to highlight their seriousness, wavered initially, in Stalin's words, so the Kremlin made matters clearer. On June 8th, Radio Moscow announced, to the great surprise of Poland's communist president Bolesław Bierut, that Poland and Romania would refuse to take part. A very agitated Bierut summoned the Soviet ambassador at 6 p.m., calling the attention of the Soviet government to the fact that the Polish government had not taken any decision in this matter, and that such communications put the leadership of the Polish Workers' Party in a very difficult situation in respect of their partners in the Democratic, i.e. Eastern, Bloc. It was to no avail. On Wednesday, July 9th, Polish Foreign Minister Zygmunt Modzelewski informed the American ambassador in Warsaw, Stanton Griffiths, in a manner extremely apologetic and at least apparently regretful, that Poland would not send a delegation to Paris, reversing the indications he had given 2 days prior. Relaying what were presumably talking points from Moscow, he said that Poland would have little or nothing to say at the conference, as the plan was already substantially fixed in form, and that rehabilitation of the aggressor nation, Germany, was wrongly being given priority over assistance to its victims. The idea of European integration as a Trojan horse for German hegemony would become a staple of communist diplomatic doctrine. Griffiths surmised that between Monday and Wednesday, Modzelewski, if not the entire Polish cabinet, had been overruled by higher authority. This development came as a grave disappointment to Ramadier, who considered Poland indispensable to European economic unity, particularly given the importance of its coal production. "To wish to have Europe stop this side of the Vistula," he told Caffery, "would be equivalent to having the United States stop at the Mississippi." In a sign that brewing Cold War politics were now infusing the Bretton Woods institutions, the World Bank halted consideration of a loan to Poland after its decision not to go to Paris. The bank's American president, John J. McCloy, said Poland's action raised the question of its independence from Russia and its ability to guarantee repayment of a loan. The only holdout at this point, as Molotov had feared, the Czechs. In some regards, Czechoslovakia might have been expected to require the least encouragement to follow orders. Unlike Poland, there were no Soviet troops in the country, yet the coalition National Front government had been largely obedient to Moscow, to which it was bound by preferential trading agreements. Communists had won 38% of the vote in the last elections, in May 1946, making them the largest party in the government. The country had been abandoned by the West to Hitler at Munich in 1938. In 1945, the Americans ceded the liberation of Prague to the Soviet Army. Stalin's portrait was ubiquitous on the city's billboards. He was, whatever his imperfections, the closest thing the country had to a guarantee against another German invasion. Yet Czechoslovakia had also received over $200 million, $2.3 billion in today's money, in much-needed American financial assistance since the war's end. Now, presented with the manna of Marshall aid, Masaryk was once again overcome by an excess of enthusiasm. "The Czech government," he told Soviet, British, and French officials on July 1st, "has authorized me to let you know that Czechoslovakia, with one voice, welcomes the opportunity that the offer outlines." To be sure, Masaryk had not yet gone rogue. He had, in fact, on July 2nd, The day Molotov stormed out of the Paris meetings with Bevan and Bideau, and 2 days before the invitations to the coming meetings had gone out, asked for and received permission from the Soviet chargé in Prague, Mikhail Bodrov, before advising the cabinet to accept the anticipated invitation. Yet this was clearly not the tone of a man whom the Kremlin could count on to storm out of a capitalist aid conference. The Czech cabinet held a heated and inconclusive debate over whether to retract the government's acceptance. Communist Prime Minister Klement Gottwald informed Bodrov of the stalemate. "The government will not support us in pulling out of the conference. The British and French have already been informed of their decision," Communist Ministry of Foreign Affairs State Secretary Vladimir Klementis added by way of explanation. "It has been carried by the press. Ambassador Yindrik Nosek in Paris has received instructions to the effect that he is entrusted with the task of attending the conference." In Moscow, Stalin did not take the news well. A Czech delegation was scheduled to arrive for trade treaty talks in a few days. The Marshall Plan would now be the main agenda. The Czechs arrived at the Kremlin on July 9th. That evening, Gottwald was summoned to meet privately with Stalin, communist to communist. His fellow delegation members waited nervously in a drawing room for hours, not knowing where he was. When he emerged, he tried to reassure them. "Everything is all right," he said. He had come to an agreement with Stalin. "We're going to see him all together later this evening." Meeting privately with Masaryk and Prokop Drtina, the National Socialist Justice Minister, however, Gottwald's tone turned severe. "Now we're in a pretty pickle, because of your policy towards the West. Never before have I seen Stalin so beside himself. He reproached me bitterly for having accepted the invitation to participate in the Paris conference. He doesn't understand how we could have done it. He insists that we acted exactly as if we were preparing to turn our backs on the Soviets. I thought we were wrong in approving that decision without first referring it to Moscow, but you people were in such a terrible hurry. Now we're in a fine mess. Stalin is furious, and I think he has a right to be. You'll see for yourselves tonight. Stalin wants us to go and see him at 11 p.m. At 11, the Generalissimo ushered them in. Masaryk was taken aback. Contrary to Gottwald's warning, he found Stalin's tone one of benevolence and calm. It was Gottwald and not Stalin who steered the discussion onto the business of Paris. He offered that his government had decided from the beginning to recall its representatives in case of need. No definitive position had ever been taken, he explained. "We now find ourselves confronted with a new situation, since we are the only Slavic state, and only state of Eastern Europe, which has accepted the invitation to go to Paris. Is it not natural, therefore, that the Czechoslovak government should wish to know the point of view of the USSR?" Masaryk now understood why Stalin was being so friendly, almost jovial. They had been set up. The game was clear. Stalin had come to an understanding with Gottwald. The interview with us was nothing but a formality. Stalin explained that he had been obliged to change his stance on Czech participation in Paris. The Soviet government had, after some investigation, determined that the great powers were attempting to form a Western bloc and isolate the Soviet Union. France, which has no program for a revival of her own economy, and Britain, which is also in dire financial straits, could not be the ones trying to put together a program for the economic revival of Europe. The instigator and main creditor behind it was, of course, the USA, because neither France nor England has a kopeck. Participation in such an American scheme would obviously endanger Czech political and economic sovereignty. Even going to Paris would show that you want to cooperate in an action aiming at isolating the Soviet Union. Masaryk still hoped the Soviet leader could see reason. 60 to 80% of Czechoslovakia's raw materials came from the West, he explained to Stalin. It was impossible for his government to ignore this fact. Drtina added that the importance of Western trade to his country was much greater than that of other Slavic states. Stalin waved them off. Czechoslovakia's trade balance with the West was an adverse one, he said. Since its exports were not substantial enough to pay for its imports, It had to pay the difference in foreign exchange. This was a bad deal. But this was a crushing argument in favor of our adherence to the plan, observed an ill and exasperated Ripka after reading the transcript in Prague. It was the very reason why Czechoslovakia needed the American credits. Stalin continued, By your participation in Paris, you let yourselves be used as a tool against the USSR. Neither the Soviet Union nor its government would tolerate it. Everyone knows what that kind of warning means in Stalin's mouth, Ripka commented, especially when it is addressed to a small neighboring country. Back in 1945, Stalin had told Czechoslovakia's socialist president Edvard Beneš that the Soviet Union will not interfere in the internal affairs of its allies. But he had prefaced this by saying that he wants nothing more than to have allies who are always prepared to resist the German danger. And an ally who accepted martial aid was assisting the German danger. It was, therefore, not an ally. Masaryk now got the message, or at least part of it. There would be no martial aid for his country. Yet he still hoped to present the world the image of an independent Czechoslovakia. The Soviet government, Masaryk pleaded to Stalin, should help us in our delicate situation. We do not have any great illusions, but perhaps the matter could be fixed in such a manner that one would go to the conference on one day and leave it on the next? No, Stalin said. Czech participation would be a break in the front, a success for the Western great powers. Switzerland and Sweden are still wavering. Your acceptance would certainly also affect their decision. Dertina tried a different tack. If the Czechs could not take American help, then surely, he put to Stalin, the Soviets could do more for them? Dertina pleaded with him to take into account the fear which our population has, that namely, the detachment from the West should not result in general impoverishment. That would not only have serious economic consequences, but also political ones. Marshal Stalin should also consider the downward turn in Czech trade with the Soviet Union. He hoped the ongoing negotiations between the two governments would improve this state of affairs. In our present situation, Masaryk summed up, we need a kind of consolation prize, a gesture of the Soviet side. Your situation is better than that of France or England, Stalin put back, but the USSR is prepared to help you in your economic affairs. It would buy more Czech industrial equipment, drilling pipes, electric motors and the like. Our harvest is good this year. The agricultural plan has been fulfilled. Indeed exceeded. We can help our friends, Bulgaria, Poland, and also you. The offer to barter food for machine parts, Stalin presented as self-evident generosity. He reiterated, however, that the Czech government needed first to reverse its decision on the conference. You could announce to Paris, Stalin suggested, that it had become evident that the acceptance of the invitation could be interpreted as a stroke against the USSR. In particular, since none of the Slav or other Eastern European states accepted the invitation. In closing, he added for good measure, I believe that the sooner you do that, the better. With that, the Czechs were dismissed. Masaryk was horrified. The Soviets, he concluded, sounded little different from Marshall after his Moscow meetings. Do not want Europe to recover economically. They are afraid of the success of the reconstruction of Western Europe. As I listened to Stalin, I had more and more clearly the feeling that he is counting on war. Everything they do is done with one aim in view. War. Prior to Marshall's speech, Stalin had wielded an iron fist at home, but had been willing to tolerate, to varying degrees, a measure of political independence, including non-communist participation in the nations just beyond Soviet borders. This tolerance was finished. Governments were now with Stalin or against him. Poland, Hungary, Romania, and Bulgaria, as well as Czechoslovakia, would all be brought to heel. Gottwald cabled the government in Prague with an account of the meeting. A Czech informant for the American embassy quickly passed on a copy to the U.S. ambassador, Lawrence Steinhardt, who forwarded it on to Marshall with instructions to the State Department to take every precaution to prevent it becoming known that the text had come from the embassy. Returning to Prague, Gottwald convened the cabinet on July 10, 2 days before the Paris conference, for a final full day of contentious discussions. The Soviets, anxious for the Czechs to make the right decision, were spreading the message that the Marshall Plan was not about helping Europe, but rebuilding Germany. Masaryk, Ripka, and the non-communists were anguished. But aware that Stalin would extinguish the embers of Czech democracy if the government did not reverse itself. The real battle in the cabinet, therefore, was over the wording of the statement which Communist Vice Premier William Shirokhi was sent out to read publicly at 9 p.m. It left little doubt as to the source of the reversal. An exceptional meeting of the government took place on July 10th that focused on the participation of Czechoslovakia at the Paris conference. It was found out that many countries rejected the invitation, especially all Slav states and other Central and Western European countries. Countries that Czechoslovakia remains in close economic and political relations with, based on contractual obligations, will not participate in the Paris conference. In this situation, the Czechoslovakian participation would be interpreted as an act against the Soviet Union and other allies. Hence, the government has decided not to participate in the conference. Clementis informed the British and French ambassadors a half hour later. Economist Ladislav Feyerabend, Minister of Finance in the London-based government in exile during the war, was appalled. "Why didn't the democratic members of Gottwald's government resign?" he asked incredulously. "This would have produced a government crisis that would either have affirmed the original decision to go to Paris or resulted in new elections. And if that had happened, and Gottwald had managed to establish a new government with a parliamentary majority, Czechoslovakia would have been in a different situation." Social Democrat Food Minister Václav Meyer said later that the humiliating about-face had smashed the illusion of Czechoslovak independence to smithereens. Ripka reported that Prague residents were calling it another Munich. "I went to Moscow as the foreign minister of an independent sovereign state," a bitter Masaryk would tell a former British diplomat, "and I returned as a lackey of the Soviet government." Masaryk and his fellow Democrats, however, too often wanted to have it both ways. Steinhardt singled out Masaryk as an example of Czechs who indulge in double talk and place bets on both sides. Upon signing the alliance agreement with Moscow in December 1943, Masaryk, as a representative of the government in exile, had declared that his country's relations with other neighbors will be from the angle of our Soviet agreement. Benes had told Molotov that, "In questions of the organization of Central Europe, we will do nothing without your consent." Fears of having no one to protect their country from Germany underlay this servility. Now, National Socialist Party Chairman Petr Zenkel, who had insisted that the government had acted correctly when it accepted the invitation to the Paris conference, was unapologetically pragmatic. "Our situation changed at the moment when the delegation was notified of the Soviet opinion toward the Marshall Plan. The political perspective trumped the economic one. We remain a faithful ally and accept both the advantages and disadvantages of this alliance." Dertina had secretly hoped the government in Prague could possibly express opposition to the overt political pressure that Stalin had put us under. However, it is questionable whether it would have been wise to accept the Paris invitation. Czechoslovakia was in no danger in case of a breakup with the Americans. However, I could not be sure of what would happen in the case of a breakup with the Soviets. The country's most important guarantee of security rested in close cooperation with the USSR. Minister of Posts František Halla insisted the government had to adapt politically to the Kremlin's position, because we have no guarantee from any other state against attack. Given Czechoslovakia's geographic position, its politicians were sensitive to the security dimensions of the Marshall Aid invitation. But as Washington would soon learn, they were not uniquely so. Even nations to the west would come to demand military protection against Germany and Russia as a condition for accepting American integration demands that would reduce their self-sufficiency and increase their economic vulnerability. From his base in Moscow, Ambassador Smith was concerned about the implications of the Czech Volt Fass for the Marshall Plan broadly. A Czechoslovak reversal on the Paris conference on Soviet orders, Smith cabled to Marshall on July 11th, is nothing less than a declaration of war by the Soviet Union on the immediate issue of the control of Europe. The lines are drawn, he concluded. Our response is awaited. I do not need to point out the repercussions of a failure to meet the Soviet challenge in terms not only of the control of Europe, but of the impact which such a failure would have in the Middle and Far East, and throughout the colonial world. The dominoes were arrayed, as Smith saw it, from Western Europe to the ends of the earth. Washington now had to act to keep them upright. Kennan, for his part, was buoyed by developments. The Russians have been smoked out in their relations with satellite countries, he memoed Marshall. Maximum strain has been placed on those relations. Furthermore, Western Communist parties were struggling to justify opposition to the plan. Events of the past weeks, therefore, had delivered the greatest blow to European communism since termination of hostilities. But the Marshall Plan had not yet united the West. It had, through very different means, only united the East. 6. Unity. July 12, 1947. Just before 11 a.m., foreign and trade ministers of 16 nations, Austria, Belgium, Denmark, France, Greece, Iceland, Ireland, Italy, Luxembourg, the Netherlands, Norway, Portugal, Sweden, Switzerland, Turkey, and the United Kingdom, entered the Grande Salle à Manger at number 37 Quai d'Orsay. Above each of the 9 doors, the sculptor Combet had carved 2 ethereal children holding a medallion crowned with acanthus leaves and fleurons, traditional European symbols of great power. Above them, the cartouche in the great ceiling's 4 corners bore France's imperial symbol. Here, in this magnificent hall consecrated to the glories of the French Empire, Europe's top diplomats assembled to plea for aid from a former British colony. They unanimously elected the British Foreign Minister as conference chairman, the price he demanded for agreeing to French hosting. Brusque and unsentimental, Bevin told the gathered that the conference was only a piece of ad hoc machinery to grapple with a special problem. It was not a time for theater or dreaming. Effective and quick action is required. His co-host, Bideau, in grandiloquent contrast, intoned that the hour had come to construct a Europe. The 2 representatives of non-communist Europe thereby highlighted the tensions inherent in American hopes for the gathering. It was to produce, on the one hand, a practical plan with immediate tangible results, and on the other, a blueprint for far-reaching and unprecedented cooperation. This difference in emphasis between the 2 visions, Europe as practical necessity and Europe as supranational aspiration, would continue to mark the British and French approaches. The conference set up a Committee of European Economic Cooperation, CEEC, to perform the actual work to be chaired by Britain's Sir Oliver Franks, an Oxford philosophy don and wartime permanent secretary in the Ministry of Supply. It also created a powerful executive committee comprising the UK, France, Italy, Norway, and the Benelux Customs Union, comprising Belgium, the Netherlands, and Luxembourg, as well as 4 technical committees with further subcommittees covering food and agriculture, fuel and power, iron and steel, and transport. There would be only 6 weeks for them to forge a plan for a new West European economy that, before Marshall's speech the month prior, few of them had ever imagined. Notwithstanding the message of unity in the CEE's name, aimed to appeal to its American benefactor, its member states formed an unlikely cast of collaborators. Some were at the center of empires, some were Lilliputians, some were rich, some poor, some dirigistes, some laissez-faire. 2 were long-standing neutrals, another was occupied by 2 of the others. Some were European in focus, others oriented outwardly. What bound them together was a need for dollars and a determination to make as few concessions as possible to American aspirations that undermined their sovereignty. 8 Eastern states had, under Moscow's instructions, declined to attend the conference: Albania, Bulgaria, Czechoslovakia, Finland, Hungary, Poland, Romania, and Yugoslavia. Spain was also conspicuous in its absence, having been excluded from the invitation owing to bitter opposition to the Franco dictatorship among Europe's political left. Whether Spain's inclusion might have ended the country's